Creation says is proper thought, proper belief, proper expression is the only thing that would be allowed, and any opposition will be punished, will be criminalized, will be suppressed.
Mara, do you believe the threat to expel American students, to imprison them, to deport some of them, is that legally enforceable, or will it face significant hurdles in court?
I believe all of these efforts will face significant hurdles in court because each and every one of these is grounded on violation of First Amendment, of the basic rights of people in the United States to be able to speak out. And each and every one of these efforts to target students, target anyone because of the content of their speech, to punish them because of the content of their speech, to target for state investigation or the imposition of, you know, state sanction because of the content of their speech runs afoul of the First Amendment, and this will be challenged.
Mara, to follow up on that, what are the prospects in the United States Supreme Court where these cases are going to end up? There are six arch conservatives, three liberals, but in some cases, that court, including the conservatives, says it believes in the First Amendment. How do you see these cases shaping up when they reach the Supreme Court?
Well, everybody says they believe in the First Amendment. I mean, one of Trump's executive orders was also about, on his first day, was about like the government not imposing restrictions on free speech and the First Amendment. So, you know, we all know what that means. They mean the First Amendment for some and not for others. And when it comes to the Supreme Court, it's a real question. I mean, the reality is when you look at First Amendment jurisprudence from the different justices on this court, there has been frequently rulings that support the First Amendment, that take a strong position or a bright line rule in support of the First Amendment, that have included very conservative judges. It is not necessarily a province of liberal versus conservative across the board. It also depends, obviously, on what the underlying fact pattern is, as we know, and what they believe the outcome will turn on. So I don't think we can say with certainty one way or the other. But it is something that the justices know and have to consider, which is when they approve violations of the First Amendment, when they approve viewpoint targeting and discrimination and repression, it is a dangerous game, and it can be applied in one direction or another direction. The question I think we really have to ask is, how much is this administration and the, you know, extremists on the court, like, how far are they going to go for it? Is there going to be a decision where they decide, yeah, we're going to green light everything that this administration wants to do, regardless of how much this steamrolls basic democratic principles that frankly keep the country afloat?
Mara, we've run out of our allotted time. How can our listeners follow your work?
We encourage people to sign up for breaking email alerts at justiceonline.org and to follow us on social media at the PCJF, as we are also looking at legal challenges that are essential here. If people want to stay abreast of that work, again, please follow us at the PCJF or sign up at justiceonline.org.
Keep up the great work, and we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives.
Today, one in five Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us do not understand what we are facing or how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness, and substance use disorder.
I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Everybody in America should be mad and angry about what we are witnessing right now in our country, including the illegal and reckless attacks on science by Elon Musk and the Trump administration.
Stand up for science. That was the rallying call at nationwide protest Friday to oppose the Trump administration's sweeping cuts for scientific research and mass layoffs at the National Institutes of Health, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and other agencies. We'll hear excerpts from the Washington rally and to speak to one of the organizers. Then ICE agents in New York have detained Mahmoud Khalil, a leader of the Gaza Solidarity Encampment at Columbia University, even though he has a green card and is a lawful permanent resident of the United States.
This encampment is a minor inconvenience compared to the generational shaping events taking place now in Gaza.
An emergency rally is being held today in New York to demand Mahmoud Khalil's release. The former Columbia graduate student's whereabouts are unknown. His wife is 8 months pregnant. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Security forces loyal to Syria's new government have been accused of massacring hundreds of civilians in coastal Alawite and Christian communities after the government said it had launched a military campaign against fighters loyal to former President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports at least 745 civilians have been killed in 29 massacres in Latakia and Tartus provinces since Thursday. Victims include children and the elderly, most of them killed execution style. The massacres came as some rebel fighters looked to punish the Alawite community because the Assad family belongs to the Alawite sect, which makes up 12% of Syria's population. Residents in Latakia condemn the massacres.
We don't want a sectarian war. We want to rebuild our country. We don't want bloodshed, neither from us nor them, because it won't change anything. There are those who benefit from war and don't want Syria to recover. They profit while civilians on both sides suffer. But we reject that. We want peace. We want our country to heal.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are facing heightened threats of thirst, disease, and starvation after Israel's energy minister abruptly shut off all electric power to Gaza on Sunday. The blackout idled a wastewater treatment plant and drastically cut clean water output from Gaza's only functioning desalination plant. The power cuts came on the eighth day of Israel's renewed blockade of humanitarian aid shipments into Gaza. There were long lines at bakeries Sunday as people queued for hours just to receive a single piece of bread.
There's a siege on all of Gaza's people from all the borders. As you can see, we're waiting for our turn to get a bag of bread. All of these people waiting for a bag of bread. This is our situation. Gaza's people need aid, our brothers. There's a siege on all Gaza's people. We're all alike now, the wealthy and the poor. Everyone is trying to get a bag of bread.
Hamas condemned Israel's shutoff of power as a, quote, desperate attempt to pressure our people and their resistance through cheap and unacceptable blackmail tactics, unquote. An Israeli delegation is headed to Qatar today for a new round of Gaza ceasefire talks, coming 10 days after the first phase expired. President Donald Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, is expected to join the talks Tuesday. Meanwhile, Yemen's Houthis have issued an ultimatum to Israel to lift its blockade of Gaza or face renewed attacks before January's ceasefire in Gaza. The Houthis launched more than 100 attacks on ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, as well as dozens of missile and drone attacks on Israel. Russian attacks on Ukraine killed at least 6 people today. Over the weekend, Moscow launched major air raids across Ukraine, killing at least 24 people Saturday, nearly half of those in Donetsk region, and destroying energy infrastructure. Russia's stepped-up attacks come after the U.S. pulled much of its support from Kyiv following President Trump's Oval Office clash with President Volodymyr Zelensky, with Trump halting U.S. military aid, intelligence sharing, and as of Friday, the sharing of satellite imagery with Ukraine. On Friday, Trump defended Putin's ramped-up attacks.
I actually think he's doing what anybody else would do. I think he wants to get it stopped and settled, and I think he's hitting them harder than he's been hitting them. And I think probably anybody in that position would be doing that right now.
President Zelensky's in Saudi Arabia for U.S.-led talks and is meeting today with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. A Ukrainian delegation will meet with its U.S. counterpart there on Tuesday. Canada's governing Liberal Party has elected Mark Carney as its new leader, setting him up to replace Justin Trudeau as prime minister in the coming days. Carney's a graduate of Oxford and Harvard who spent over a decade at the Wall Street investment firm Goldman Sachs. He previously served as governor of the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England before becoming an economic advisor to Trudeau. In his victory speech Sunday, Carney pledged Canada would win the trade war started by President Donald Trump.
The Americans want our resources, our water, our land, our country. Think about it. If they succeeded, they would destroy our way of life. In America, healthcare is a big business. In Canada, it is a right.
Carney is widely expected to call for a snap election to capitalize on his rising popularity. The Trump administration says it's stripping union protections for 47,000 workers at the Transportation Security Administration, including the right to collective bargaining. American Federation of Government Employees National President Everett Kelly condemned the move as a, quote, pretext for attacking the rights of regular working Americans across the country because they happen to belong to a union, he said. On Friday, some 80,000 workers at the Department of Health and Human Services were offered lump sum payments of up to $25,000 if they agree by March 14th to resign. The buyout offer came after some federally funded researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention received a survey requiring them to detail how their work aligns with the goals of the Trump administration. ABC News reports they were asked whether their research would help combat, quote, Christian persecution, unquote, defend women and children against so-called gender ideology extremism, or help curb immigration. Meanwhile, at the New York Times, the paper is reporting President Trump moved to rein in Elon Musk's power after an explosive cabinet meeting at the White House last Thursday. The Times reports Secretary of State Marco Rubio was incensed after Musk accused him of failing to fire enough staff at the State Department. Meanwhile, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy criticized Musk's cuts at the Federal Aviation Administration. Duffy reportedly said, quote, I have multiple plane crashes to deal with now, and your people want me to fire air traffic controllers, unquote. President Trump signed an executive order terminating security clearances of workers at Perkins Coie, the law firm that represented Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. A spokesperson for Perkins Coie called Trump's move patently unlawful and promised a legal challenge. This comes just weeks after Trump signed another executive order targeting the Washington, D.C. law firm Covington & Burling, which employs lawyers who worked in the Obama and Biden administrations and who recently aided Jack Smith, the special counsel who led investigations into Trump. Immigration agents with the Department of Homeland Security have detained a Columbia University graduate student for helping lead campus encampment protests. Mahmoud Khalil, who's an Algerian citizen of Palestinian descent, is a green card holder and is married to a U.S. citizen. His wife is 8 months pregnant. Immigration officials told Khalil's lawyer his green card is being revoked. The journalist Prem Thacker, who broke the story and will be joining us on Democracy Now! Later in the broadcast, says DHS claims Khalil, quote, led activities aligned to Hamas, unquote. His arrest follows Trump's executive orders targeting free speech and protests on college campuses. The arrest came as the Trump administration withdrew $400 million in federal grants and contracts to Columbia University for failing to address so-called anti-Semitic harassment at its campus. In fact, Columbia repeatedly targeted Palestinian rights protesters on its campuses and called in police to brutally crack down on a peaceful student movement. We'll have more on these stories later in the broadcast. We'll be speaking with a Columbia University professor. The dean of Georgetown University's law school has rejected a warning from the acting federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., who said his office won't consider Georgetown students for jobs, internships, or fellowships until Georgetown Law School ends diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Acting U.S. Attorney Ed Martin made the threat in an email March 3rd, writing it's unacceptable that Georgetown Law, quote, continues to promote and teach DEI, unquote. Dean William Traynor wrote in response, quote, given the First Amendment's protection of a university's freedom to determine its own curriculum and how to deliver it, the constitutional violation behind this threat is clear, as is the attack on the university's mission as a Jesuit and Catholic institution, he wrote. Elected officials joined large crowds in Selma, Alabama, Sunday to march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge commemorating the 60th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. 85-year-old Spiver Gordon was one of those who followed the late civil rights leader turned Congressmember John Lewis across the bridge in 1965 when they were brutally attacked by Alabama state troopers.
There's a different day, different flavor, but the same labor. We got Donald Trump now, and of course, he's trying to turn back the clock and trying to stop us from moving forward. And of course, those of us who are of the movement know that we have to continue.
Lawyers warn transgender women prisoners have been transferred to federal men's prisons as part of Trump's order denying trans existence and rights. This despite multiple court rulings blocking the policy. But court rulings so far have only shielded the 17 trans plaintiffs in the cases, leaving others vulnerable to relocation, where they have already reported sexual misconduct by prison guards and having thoughts of suicide. California Governor Gavin Newsom has come under fire by fellow Democrats after he characterized allowing transgender athletes to compete as deeply unfair. He made the comments during an interview on his podcast with MAGA influencer Charlie Kirk. In response, the organization Human Rights Campaign said, quote, the path to 2028 isn't paved with the betrayal of vulnerable communities, unquote. A group of arts organizations focused on transgender and non-binary communities have sued the National Endowment for the Arts, or NEA, after it imposed new grant requirements conforming to Trump's executive order banning the promotion of so-called gender ideology. The ACLU, which is representing the plaintiffs, said, quote, this gag on artist speech has had a ripple effect across the entire art world from Broadway to community art centers, unquote. In Washington, D.C., drag performers led a protest outside the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts on Friday to protest President Trump's takeover of the institution. Last month, Trump fired the Kennedy Center's president, replaced its board of trustees, and named himself chairman, writing that those fired, quote, do not share our vision for a golden age in arts and culture, unquote. Drag performer Lord Henry spoke at the protest.
We demand that the Kennedy Center board reinstate queer programming, including but not limited to drag-oriented workshops and shows, and any other equity and DEI initiatives at the Kennedy Center. We want to force Congress to drop the multiple attempts at criminalizing gender nonconformity, including Trump's executive order conflating sex and gender, and the attack on drag artists through budget amendments, denying funds to organizations, supporting and protecting this queer art form, as well as so much more.
And rallies took place across the globe Saturday to mark International Women's Day. Here in the United States, protesters largely focused on Trump and the Republican Party's attacks on women and the LGBTQ plus community. This is a rally goer in New York.
I can't believe we're here again for this, and that women's rights consistently are under attack. And not only are women's rights under attack, but our less fortunate, our black family, our LGBTQ family. There are very scary and very real things in Project 2025, and we are seeing that book becoming the law of the land over the Constitution.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, Stand Up for Science. Thousands rally across the country to oppose the Trump administration. Stay with us.
Sometimes you picture me, I'm walking too far ahead. You're calling to me, I can't hear what you've said. Then you said.
After Time by Cyndi Lauper. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Stand Up for Science. That was the rallying call at nationwide protest Friday to oppose the Trump administration's sweeping cuts to scientific research and mass layoffs impacting numerous agencies, including the National Institutes of Health, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, National Weather Service. Protests were held in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco, in Denver, in Boston, and over two dozen other cities. In D.C., thousands gathered at the Lincoln Memorial. In a moment, we'll speak to one of the rally organizers. But first, we turn to some of the speakers. This is Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland.
Are we all here to defend science? Because we know that when you defend science, you are defending the health and welfare of the American people. Isn't that right? Now, I am just thrilled to be here with so many mad scientists. And you should be mad, and you should be angry, and everybody in America should be mad and angry about what we are witnessing right now in our country, including the illegal and reckless attacks on science by Elon Musk and the Trump administration. Because those illegal attacks are literally putting people's lives at risk around the country. Are we going to let that happen?
It is my great honor to introduce our next speaker. Dr. Atul Gawande is the former assistant. is the former assistant administrator for global health at USAID.
Are you scientists? Are you health professionals? Are you nerds? We have a job to do. Are you with me on this job? This job is that we must bear witness. We must bear witness to the harm, to the dangerous game that they are playing, and to the truth. Here's the game that they are playing. They take a spreadsheet with the work of thousands of scientists and professionals. They scan for examples they can distort and ridicule. They ask no one what their work actually is. They ignore obvious information about it. They'll call hormone and transgenic research in mice making transgender mice.
That's stupid.
They'll ridicule male circumcision programs in Mozambique, which cuts HIV transmission 2/3 and has saved thousands of people from HIV. They will call programs to prevent HIV in transgender populations, in men who have sex with men, in IV drug users. They will call that DEI. When they will cause deaths from this occurring. Then they make absurd claims that this indicates rampant waste and fraud.
Lies.
Boo.
Lies.
They'll demand that there is loyalty to repeat these lies. And then they use the lies to gleefully stop serious important funding and work. They will use these lies to take down entire agencies like USAID.
Boo!
They destroy thousands of careers. I watched people walk out the door with their boxes containing their entire careers, fired and purged by the thousands. Then they deny the harm to millions of lives. They've done it at USAID. They are now doing it at NIH, at CDC, at FDA, and beyond. Shame. Shame. It is shame.
Shame.
They are denying the harm in order to destroy an engine that made the U.S. the greatest driver of science, of health, and of prosperity in the world.
Hi, everyone. My name is Emily Whitehead, and I am here today because almost 15 years ago, I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia at the age of 5. The doctors told my parents that if you have a kid with cancer, ALL is the most curable. However, that wasn't the case for me. After undergoing 22 months of failed chemotherapy, they were ready to send me home on hospice and told my parents to enjoy the days that they have left with me. But miraculously, a phase one clinical trial at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia had just opened and was ready to try it on their first pediatric patient. In April of 2012, I became the first child in the world to receive CAR T-cell therapy, which trained my immune system to beat my cancer. Today, I am almost 13 years cancer-free. I am a sophomore at the University of Pennsylvania studying English and photography. I am a patient advocate who spreads awareness of less toxic cancer treatments that exist today because of science. Without funding research that went into developing the treatment that saved my life, I wouldn't be here today. I stand up for science for all of the other children all over the world who are fighting cancer so they can get back to their childhood outside of the hospital. I stand up for science so kids can grow up to be the next generation of scientists. I stand up for science for underrepresented groups whose voices are not as heard as mine. Every child deserves equal and equitable access to life-saving treatments, no matter their background, identities, or where they come from. I stand up for science because science saved my life, and that is a fact. Thank you.
My name is Michael Mann, and let me warn you, I'm going to use the C word. I'm a climate scientist. Thank you. Thank you. I'm also an educator and a science communicator. Thanks. I've known adversity, having been targeted by fossil fuel interest groups, attacked by right-wing news sites, news outlets, and singled out by climate change-denying politicians. Yes, unfortunately. And it's even worse today. All in an effort to discredit my research demonstrating the profound threat of human-caused climate change. But this is the most challenging moment I can recall. For science itself to gratuitously quote the title of my forthcoming book with vaccine scientist Peter Hotez, who some of you may know, Science is Under Siege.
Up next, I have the great pleasure to introduce one of my mentors and one of my role models and scientific heroes. Dr. Francis Collins is an American physician scientist who discovered the genes associated with a number of diseases and led the Human Genome Project. He served as director of the NIH 2009 to 2021, serving under three presidents. Dr. Collins announced his retirement publicly from the NIH 6 days ago on March 1st, 2025, after 32 years of service.
So we're gathered here in front of the Lincoln Memorial. It's a sacred civic space. And we're celebrating the achievements of science over decades in bettering the human condition and advocating for strong public support at a time when serious threats of harm are happening. I'm a physician scientist. You heard, I spent 32 years at NIH, including, including leading the Human Genome Project and serving presidents of both parties as the director. But I'm a patriot. I love my country. And I'm worried about my country right now. Just behind me, if you go and visit the memorial, you'll see etched on the wall the 271 unforgettable words of the Gettysburg Address. It occurs to me there might be a parallel there to what we're talking about. Let me remind you of the last sentence of that Gettysburg Address. That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Are we still there? Well, science has been of the people, hasn't it? We're studying ourselves sometimes to help ourselves to flourish. The Human Genome Project, after all, this 13-year effort revealed our own instruction book. This has transformed human biology and medicine. And please note this. That project only succeeded through the strong support of members of Congress and presidents of both parties back then. A little fun fact. Estimates several years ago suggest that every dollar the government invested in the Human Genome Project led to $141 in economic returns. Not a bad ROI. We should keep emphasizing that part for the people who are less swayed by arguments about saving lives. We are also saving money. Come on. You know, that same visionary of the people perspective has birthed a number of other bold projects supported by the federal government. The Brain Initiative. Yeah? Figuring out how those 86 billion neurons between your ears do what they do? We're on the path to do that. The All of Us Initiative that's enrolled almost a million Americans to figure out genetics, environment, health behaviors, social, all those inputs to faith, to health that we don't understand well enough. That is a big, bold effort. But I have to tell you, both of those groundbreaking projects, Brain and All of Us, are now at severe risk because of budget and workforce cuts.
Voices from the Stand Up for Science rally in Washington, D.C. Friday. That last voice was Dr. Francis Collins, a former director of National Institutes of Health, post he held from 2009 to 2021. He just retired from the NIH after 32 years. We also heard from climate scientist Michael Mann, cancer survivor, now UPenn student Emily Whitehead, Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, and former USAID official and author Dr. Atul Kawande, whose books include Being Mortal, Medicine, and What Matters in the End. We're joined right now by one of the core organizers of the Stand Up for Science rallies. Emma Courtney joins us here in New York, a biology PhD candidate at Cold Spring Harbor, an independent lab in New York. Emily, I mean, this wasn't just in Washington, D.C., where thousands turned out. Thousands rallied in San Francisco and over two dozen cities around the country. Scientists, well, they describe themselves, many of them, as mad scientists. That's scientists who are really mad. Emily, talk about the organizing campaign and what's at stake right now.
Yeah, so I'm coming at it from a graduate student perspective, where I'm currently looking at what my thesis is going to look like over the next 3 years, and realizing that a lot of the ways that I've originally kind of thought about my science are being impacted by these current executive orders and budget cuts and kind of the censorship of science that's happening right now. And so that, I think, is where a lot of people are coming at, is looking at what they're doing and the impact it has on communities, and then looking at also how that's being taken away right now.
Emma, you're a cancer researcher?
I am.
So talk about the level of the cuts, whether we're talking about NOAA, the climate scientists, people like Dr. Michael Mann, whether we're talking about basic cancer research, and also how is this affecting your colleagues, older and also students, whether they can trust staying in basic science?
Yeah, definitely. I think we're seeing right now kind of a orders saying like which words you can and can't use in your grant proposals. And so I am coming from a breast cancer perspective. I study breast cancer. I study women's health. And right now you're not able to really put into proposals that you are studying women or females or looking at barriers or looking even at how race can influence cancer outcomes.
You mean you can't say words like barrier,
yes,
race, women in the grant proposals?
No, that's the current advice, is grants are getting flagged for having language that is containing those words.
You know, it's really interesting. One of the beneficiaries of the National Institutes of Health may have an interesting father. Mother Jones is reporting that the Vogt family, as in Russell Vogt, the head of the OMB, but more significantly, considered the architect of Project 2025, his daughter had cystic fibrosis. They credit a cystic fibrosis drug, Trifacta, for helping their daughter's treatment. That research for Trifacta was funded by the National Institutes of Health. Talk about the significance of basic research when it comes to, I even think about the child who President Trump honored in his congressional address, a young man, child, who has cancer, pediatric cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the National Institutes of Health fund a lot of basic research that's really critical in providing kind of the scaffold for these treatments later on. And so when we're looking at cuts to the NIH, we're looking both at cuts to the workforce and the opportunities available to scientists, but we're also looking at kind of the impact long term of losing these basic science projects that really have the opportunity to drive cures for people like individuals with cystic fibrosis and cancer. And a lot of these, they're not, it's incremental steps over time is how science works. And so the basic research, it might not seem immediately impactful all the time, but as you compound these findings over years and you have scientists continually working to find cures, things do happen and we get to these treatments that are very transformative for the people with these diseases.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Recently announced that HHS would no longer allow public comments in the rulemaking process, ending a policy of a half a century to involve public opinion in HHS decisions. Your response?
I think it's very important to have the input of scientists and people who have personal interest in these topics. I think their comments are really useful in making sure that our policies are informed by science and rooted in evidence and have the ability to really drive progress. I think when we have kind of a unilateral decision-making power, we're maybe losing out on perspectives that are really critical and just making sure that science is able to help the people that need it most.
Emma, I also wanted to ask you about scientists around the world and warnings your institutions, whether we're talking about universities or independent labs. In our next segment, we're going to talk about a young former graduate student who has a green card, has just been taken by ICE. We're not sure where he is. But the warning that was put out to people on visas around the world who work at, in your world, and at scientific establishment in this country.
Yes, so we had a lot of discussions leading up to the event on March 7th about how we could best include international scientists and not put a target on their back, because we know that there's currently this order where visas can be canceled and you can kind of face repercussions that you would not face as a citizen if you're on a visa. And so we wanted to make sure that there's a way to productively engage, but I think it became even more severe when we did have that post put out where President Trump did allege that you, if you partook in an illegal protest, you could face significant repercussions to your visa. And so I think that is harmful right now, because science is such an international endeavor. It is, America is such a land of opportunity for young scientists. It brings so many scientists over from other countries for training that then go on and make significant impacts both in the U.S. and in their home communities and worldwide. And so we really want to make sure as well within Stand Up for Science that we are speaking to the perspectives of international students and those who might not currently have a voice because of these orders.
Yeah. Where do you go next? Where is this rally that attracted thousands across the country?
That's what we're currently trying to figure out. And so we are a group of early career scientists. None of us have done significant political organizing in the past. And so we're kind of taking a step back and looking at what matters to people right now. What are the best places? We want to make sure that we're taking into account all perspectives, because we are right now, this was something that was put together very quickly. It had impact. It has momentum. And now how do we use that to really drive change is what we're looking to answer.
Emma Courtney, a biology PhD candidate at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York, core organizer for Friday's Stand Up for Science rally. And a correction on that cystic fibrosis drug, it's called Trikafta. This is Democracy Now! Coming up, ICE agents in New York have detained Mahmoud Khalil. He's a former Columbia University graduate student, leader of the Gaza Solidarity Encampment. Even though he has a green card and is a lawful permanent resident of the United States, we'll talk about his case, where is he, and also that the Trump administration has now said they are cutting $400 million from Columbia's budget. Stay with us. Thank you.
for Rafat Alarir by Vijay Iyer and Wadada Leo Smith. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An emergency rally is being held in New York today after ICE agents detained a leader of the Gaza Solidarity Encampment at Columbia University. Mahmoud Khalil is an Algerian citizen of Palestinian descent who's a green card holder and a lawful permanent resident of the United States. He's married to a U.S. citizen. His wife is 8 months pregnant. Immigration officials told Khalil's lawyer his green card is being revoked. Khalil recently graduated from Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, SIPA. His whereabouts are unknown, though there are reports he might be in Louisiana. In a statement, his lawyer, Amy Greer, said, quote, ICE's arrest and detention of Mahmoud follows the U.S. government's open repression of student activism and political speech, specifically targeting students at Columbia University for criticism of Israel's assault on Gaza. The U.S. government has made clear they will use immigration enforcement as a tool to suppress that speech, unquote. Mahmoud Khalil was a key organizer of the Columbia encampment. This is Mahmoud speaking on campus in April.
This encampment is a minor inconvenience compared to the generational shaping events taking place now in Gaza. Throughout the negotiations, the Shafi administration treated this movement as a matter of internal student discipline rather than a movement, or rather than as one of the great moral and political questions of this generation. Columbia's short-sighted political decision making today in the face of a genocide that has stolen the lives of over 34,000 human beings, women, men, babies in Gaza, that has destroyed lineages and heritage sites and universities, will be a stain on its legacy forever. The students on this encampment are a gift to Colombia. We offered to give university back its principles. With all eyes on Colombia, the administration could have chosen to divest in a manner that aligned with its past. Colombia would rather trample its reputation instead of being proud of its students and faculty for raising these incredibly important moral questions. We have been hit with little more than threats and petty attacks. This is not a matter of simply violating university rules. This is a movement, an anti-war movement. We have sparked similar Gaza solidarity encampments across the nation and even across the globe.
So that was Mahmoud Khalil speaking in April at the Gaza Solidarity Encampment at Columbia University. He was detained by ICE on Saturday. On Sunday night, Secretary of State Marco Rubio shared an article about Khalil and wrote on X, "We'll be revoking the visas and or green cards of Hamas supporters in America so they can be deported," unquote. Khalil's arrest came as the Trump administration withdrew $400 million in federal grants and contracts to Columbia University for failing to stop, quote, anti-Semitic harassment at its campus. In fact, Columbia repeatedly targeted Palestinian rights protesters, many of them Jewish, and called in police to crack down on the peaceful student movement. We're joined now by two guests. Prem Thakkar is political correspondent and columnist for Zatayo News. He's also a Columbia graduate. His most recent piece, DHS Detains Palestinian Students from Columbia Encampment, advocates say. We're also joined by Joseph Howley, an associate professor of classics at Columbia University. Professor Howley, let's begin with you. Can you explain what happened to Mahmoud Khalil on Saturday? Where was he? How was he taken? And how is it possible he was taken, given that he has a green card?
Well, there's a lot of questions in there we don't know the answers to. And everything I know about what happened to Mahmoud comes from his lawyer and his family, because we've still received no communication from the university. Our understanding is that he and his wife, who is a U.S. citizen, who's 8 months pregnant, were returning home here in the neighborhood, and that plainclothes DHS agents forced their way into their home behind them, told Mahmoud that his student visa had been revoked. When it was explained that he had a green card, they seemed confused, got on the phone with someone, declared that the green card had also been revoked. Mahmoud's lawyer got on the phone with them, demanded to see the warrant, and they hung up and they took him off. And no one was able to find him, you know, I think for at least 24 hours.
And can you talk about what people's responses right now, staff, students around Colombia, how people are organizing?
Well, this is something that I think is very frightening for a lot of members of our community. I have colleagues and students, you know, messaging me since yesterday, asking about whether it's safe to be on campus, asking about canceling classes or taking classes remote because they don't know how safe it is to be on or around campus with ICE agents prowling the neighborhood. And, you know, we have a lot of members of our community who are on student visas. We have a lot of members of our community who are permanent residents. And so I think people are wondering now, you know, how is it safe to be here on campus?
And can you talk about the atmosphere on campus?
Well, campus has been under a security lockdown since last April, since before the first Gaza Solidarity encampment went up. So walking into campus this morning, things were very quiet, but they're always very quiet now. They've been quiet for months and months. It feels like we're under, you know, a heavy security regimen.
What are you calling for? And can you talk about your criticism of the Columbia campus around the issue of the pro-Palestinian protests that took place all last year, how Columbia dealt with it? Ultimately, you have the president, Manoush Shafiq, leaving. The president had called in police over and over again.
Sure. Look, for the last year, a number of my colleagues and I have been trying to make the point to university leadership, to our colleagues, that these attacks on the Palestine Solidarity Movement as somehow inherently anti-Semitic, or the idea that the presence of the Solidarity Movement poses a threat to all Jewish students on campus, are very dangerous lies and bad faith attacks on higher education that we really should be engaging with as threats rather than as sincere complaints. So we wrote a letter to former President Shafiq last spring, that we published. We've written a few other letters and statements since then. And the point is really this. We know that the political right in this country hates higher education and wants to destroy it or remake it in its own image. We've seen this in the public education system in places like Florida and North Carolina. And it's been very clear to anyone who's watching since last spring that this issue is being used as a wedge. But now what we can see is that everyone who spent the year pointing to anyone with a keffiyeh and yelling Hamas, pointing to anyone with a Palestinian flag and calling them a terrorist, everyone who spent the last year going on the public record and saying that Colombia has some sort of uniform cultural widespread problem with anti-Semitism has been, you know, loading the gun for the Trump administration to do what they always wanted to do, which is cripple major institutions of learning in this country.
Professor Hawley, Professor Hawley, if you could talk about the criticism that what's going on campus is anti-Semitic. In fact, are you yourself Jewish?
I am Jewish, and you know, I don't really like playing that card, but it's become very important for those of us who are Jewish and do not subscribe to the idea that the presence of this protest movement is anti-Semitic to stand up and say so. But look, we do have problems with, you know, harassment and bias towards Jewish students. We have problems with harassment and bias towards Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian students. Every time Israel goes on a new killing spree in the occupied Palestinian territories, anti-Semitism surges around the world. Every time, you know, Hamas kills hundreds of people, we have to deal with attacks on Muslims and Arabs. We have a widespread climate problem here because this is an international campus. But, you know, using the ADL's playbook under the guise of protecting Jewish students to suppress the protest movement has not been making anyone safer.
Can you talk about what has happened now and if you believe other students have been taken by ICE?
You know, we don't have a lot of information about this. My understanding is that on Friday, not long after the federal government announced the funding freeze, that ICE agents tried to gain access to another student residence. We don't know yet or I don't know yet if anyone else has been detained at this point. But, you know, I've been hearing from students in the last 24 hours that there are rumors or reports of more ICE activity in the neighborhood today. And we haven't gotten anything from the university administration about any of this, except to say that Columbia follows the law.
And your response to this happening at the same time, your university, Columbia, now the federal government is cutting off $400 million to the university. We just had a segment on the attack on science. We're talking about across the board in Columbia, right? Basic scientific research and beyond.
Yeah. It's going to be devastating. I mean, it's, you know, experiments are going to languish. People are going to lose their jobs. Labs are going to get shut down. And of course, it's not just about the war on science. It's about the war on higher education. But I think the crucial thing to pay attention to here is that the cover that the White House is using for this is this claim that Columbia has done nothing to address this rampant climate of anti-Semitism. I've already told you I would dispute that characterization of the climate on campus. But it's also clear that the university has done a great deal about this. We have, you know, a large new Office of Inclusion and Equity that's been investigating every conceivable complaint of anti-Semitism, including some that seem really kind of spurious or excessive. I think it's outrageous that we should be taking lectures from a White House on anti-Semitism, a White House that's probably the most anti-Semitic administration in American history. And I think it's preposterous that we as an institution should try to bargain or engage in good faith on the question of anti-Semitism with, you know, neo-Nazis and segregationists and great replacement theorists. Like, I'm old enough to remember when Donald Trump supporters marched through the campus of the University of Virginia chanting, "Jews will not replace us." I'm old enough to remember when the Republican Party's xenophobic propaganda about migrants convinced someone to shoot up the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh. This is not a political movement that cares about keeping Jews or anyone else safe. This is a political movement that is willing to instrumentalize the fear and confusion of Jews to crush any kind of dissent in this country and to break higher education.
Can you also talk about Columbia and Barnard expelling student protesters? The Nation magazine recently noted, according to the group Columbia University Apartheid Divest, the last expulsion for nonviolent political protest at the school was in 1936, when Robert Burke was expelled for rallying against Columbia's ties to Nazism.
Yeah, so Barnard had recently expelled two students only a couple of weeks after they allegedly participated in a classroom disruption here on Columbia's campus. And I think it's pretty clear to everyone that expulsion is an incredibly drastic response to any kind of infraction here, especially one that amounts to, you know, a speech violation. My colleagues at Barnard tell me this expulsion was done without anything like due process, that the disciplinary process and oversight by faculty over there is really in shambles. I think the important thing to remember here is that these are institutions of learning. And when we expel students summarily, we deprive ourselves of the opportunity to help them learn. So I don't know what anyone thinks expelling students is going to achieve except appeasing the right wingers in D.C. But I think we can see that there's actually no amount of discipline or suppression that will appease them, because they don't really care about anti-Semitism or keeping Jews safe. All they care about is crushing dissent.
And do you think this is just about the pro-Palestinian protests? I mean, as we move forward, the message being sent around protests on campus, Professor?
Yeah, look, this is, I mean, you remember what the backlash was like after the uprising in 2020, after the killing of George Floyd, right? This is in part about whether we're going to be allowed to have mass protest movements in this country, whether we're going to be allowed to have youth protest movements and student protest movements. And my colleagues and I have been saying for a year now that one reason we need to stand up better to bad faith lies about the Palestine solidarity movement is that this is about establishing a precedent for imposing speech codes on higher education and on American society generally. So right now it's Palestine. Next, it's going to be race or gender or trans rights or climate.
We're also joined, in addition to Professor Joseph Howley, by Prem Tucker. He is a political correspondent, columnist for Zateo News. You've been reporting extensively on the ICE raid on the home of this former Columbia graduate student. Talk more about what you know, how they're justifying the green card holder having his green card revoked, and now his 8-month pregnant wife
is not able to find out where he is, let alone anyone else, including his lawyer.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Professor. Yes, I think one thing that's really worth underscoring here is just how clumsy and haphazard this attempt by the administration has been to detain Mahmoud and to subsequently revoke his green card. First of all, as the professor said, these agents forced themselves into this apartment building, did not necessarily apparently introduce themselves, demanded to see their identification, Mahmoud and his wife, and they first chose to tell him that they were revoking his visa, that the State Department was revoking his visa. Upon them being told that, in fact, Mahmoud had a green card, they were on the phone. They said, oh, actually, you know, the green card's revoked as well. And so that was the basis for the consequent or subsequent way in which this has been seen, which is that the administration has been very lackluster in their explanation for how this is justifiable at all. First, the shadowy arrest and detention at all, the fact that it's unclear where Mahmoud is right now. I can sort of break some potential possible news right now that it seems, based on internal ICE detaining tracking, that Mahmoud appears to be in Louisiana, as was feared. That is not confirmed, but that is what we are seeing from the ICE detention tracker, which can sometimes be delayed or lagged. But that is something to keep in mind, that Mahmoud, who was detained in New York City, is 36 hours later already possibly in Louisiana. So there's that aspect, the shadowy aspect of this. There's also the aspect that the administration doesn't seem to know exactly how to justify this very haphazard unilateral move and is trying to appeal to simply President Trump's executive orders rather than things like the Constitution or case law or legal precedent. You have Marco Rubio, as mentioned, saying that they will be revoking not just visa cards, but also and/or green cards, which is very much beyond his sort of stated authority, his jurisdiction. There's one individual law that gives him wide authority to do so, but this would require Marco Rubio personally interfering on foreign policy grounds to justify such a deportation. And so I think you're going to see a lot of not just moral pushback, but legal pushback against something that is just so haphazard, so reckless, and so unjustifiable in so many different ways.
And what do you understand about the university, Columbia University? How much are they or are they resisting this pressure from the administration or even the arrest of Mahmoud?
So we had asked the university pretty early on about, you know, sort of their awareness of ICE and DHS activity on campus during and before this detention, if they had shared any student information or campus affiliate information with authorities. And they chose not to answer those questions. They directed us to this broader statement regarding guidance that they had sort of coincidentally issued to campus affiliates just before this had happened about what affiliates should do if they see ICE or DHS activity on campus. So beyond the sort of suspect or interesting timing, what's interesting is that in this guidance, it sort of contrasts as to how the university sort of operated in 2016 during Trump's first term, while the school was led by a First Amendment scholar and Columbia president Lee Bollinger, in which they were much more firm in saying that they wouldn't allow immigration authorities to be on campus without a warrant, that they wouldn't share information with authorities unless they were ordered by a court or subpoenaed. Whereas in this new guidance, they sort of have this more open tolerance or idea to the idea that DHS or ICE agents might need to access buildings even without a warrant, and that campus affiliates, quote, should not interfere if that's the case under sort of exigent circumstances, as the school calls them. And so there's already this sort of shifting in rhetoric from Trump in his first term to Trump in his second term, from the Columbia's point of view. And you can see that manifesting in what we've seen this weekend, and as the professor has said, with reports of more ICE and DHS presence even up to today.
And Prem Tucker, the firing of, the forcing out of the professor, law professor Catherine Franken, we just have 30 seconds. This also coming within this period. She was a law professor for almost a quarter of a century at Columbia.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I believe the firing of Professor Catherine Franke, you can see more about that in our Zateo Town Hall today with her, actually. She is amongst an array of sort of victims, people caught up in the crossfire, being targeted, as Professor Hawley said, for this right-wing attack on academic freedom, on institutions, on free speech, on the ability for professors to advocate for their students to express their own free speech rights, to speak out against war, to speak out on behalf of Palestinians. And this is only a sort of broader sort of warning sign of what's to come if there is not an organized, coherent opposition.
We're going to have to leave it there, Prem Tucker. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Political correspondent, columnist for Zatea. We'll link to your articles. And Professor Hawley, thanks so much for joining us.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Way back to your side.